ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This August, Science Week is blooming around the ABC.
This Science Week, we're celebrating Australia's wildflowers.
Get involved. Vote now in the search for Australia's favourite wildflower.
At abc.net.au/science. Celebrate Science Week with us in August on ABC Radio National
and at abc.net.au/science.
Hello, it's The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. Best music by Philip Glass, as you probably worked out. It's one of his piano etudes, and it's being played by Maki Namikawa. She's a Japanese pianist in Australia for performances of his music. She's playing the first 10 of his 20 etudes, and she's going to join me later on the show. You'll also hear from Philip Glass himself from a conversation we had at the Perth Festival in 2013. But first, in the ABC's music studio, we have Kate Miller-Heitke. She's going to perform a couple of songs from her new album. It's called The Kiss and the Abyss. It's her first album since 2020. In the meantime, she's been doing things like working on musicals, but she's here with her musical partner, Kia Nuttall, to sing for us. And this is called Butterflies.
I sat too long with my shadow. I lugged her around on my back till the shadow took me over and I found comfort in the black. But something's gotta give. I'm making a clean break. It kills me to relive all of my mistakes. I must have been sleeping since now I awake. And oh, it hurts to say goodbye. Part of me is gonna die. But the thing with the wings that lives inside, keeping it waiting. And oh, it's hard to open my eyes. Heaven knows what I could find. But it's not so strange feeling butterflies. Butterflies just mean you're changing.
Changing. You're changing.
But it's not so strange feeling butterflies. Butterflies just mean you're changing.
Live in the Music Show studio, that was Kate Miller-Heitke and Kia Nuttall. And Butterflies, which comes from the new album, The Kiss and the Abyss. Thank you very much. What a beautiful song, Kate.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much.
I wonder whether it's a germane song in terms of, you know, this album, because it's been a while coming.
It has been. It's been, yeah, Jesus, 6 years since the last one. Takes a long time to make a record. But this album is kind of going back to my folky roots. And, yeah, Butterflies lives in that world. We were aiming to make a record of gothic folk and, you know, of course it kind of expanded out from there. But Butterflies is a song about it's about changing, duh, but it's about leaving part of yourself behind, almost having to kill part of yourself off to make room for the change.
And the album has a incredible confidence to it, I think. Dare I say maturity?
I love that. And yeah, I feel that too. I feel that this is the record that I'm most proud of and that represents me most fully musically. We weren't trying to fit any boxes. We were just really expansive, and I feel that, you know, the gothic folk kind of umbrella allowed me to go beautiful and acoustic and lots of wooden instruments and all that, but also bring some of that drama and theatricality into the record in a way that I've never done before. And I guess everyone says their most recent album is their favourite, but in this case I think it's actually true.
And it's not like you've been cooling your heels for the last 6 years. You might not have put out an album, but you've done other stuff, haven't you? And you've been, you know, on stage. You've been writing for the theatre.
Yes, we have. Kia wrote the script for this incredible musical called Banana Land, which we had seasons in Brisbane and Sydney. That was a lot of fun, about about a punk band that is forced to become a kids band because they accidentally have a hit single that's big with the kids. So that was a lot of work and a lot of fun. I've also been dipping a toe into the world of television as a coach on The Voice, and we're doing a bunch of stuff. What else have we done, Keir? I swear we've done something else. We opened Muriel's Wedding, the musical for which we wrote the music. We opened that over in England last year, which was very exciting.
That's enough. That's enough for anybody. But the fact that you are writing for the theatre, I wonder whether that has changed the nature of your writing full stop. I mean, you mentioned in the context of this album, you said the word dramatic, I think, and maybe that's not a coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that's a strain that's always been there. I studied opera and have always loved using my voice in a sort of over-the-top way. There's something about incorporating operatic elements into pop music or folk music that I find kind of irresistible, and it can be dramatic or it can be comical. It can be all those things. But yeah, I think you're right in that writing for these musicals, we've written for Shakespeare plays, for Melbourne Theatre Company, and Banana Land, Muriel's Wedding, The Rabbits. It did give me a more vivid sense of what it means to write from the perspective of a different character. And that is kind of a rich vein to mine because, you know, my life is only so interesting. I'm a 44-year-old mother. So I do like to kind of try to inhabit the spirit of someone else when I write songs.
So that's not you in Holiday then?
Well, actually, that one is me.
We should listen to Holiday because we can listen to it from the album and get a sense of the layers that are in some of the songs on the album. And then we'll come back and talk. And a language warning for this one.
I'm ordering the extra, extra large.
with a side of potato cakes. The cold potato scallops in Queensland. I'm having a holiday. I am turning my phone all the way off. I am having a luxurious sleep in. I'm reading a trashy book. I am having a holiday. I am having a holiday. Get your hat, get your towel, have a wee, get your sunscreen on. Come on, dickheads, we're going to the beach. And relax, relax, yeah. Water, sun, sky, I'm really chilling down to the next level. Hey, relax, relax, baby, that's right. Just getting away from it all. Disappointing sight.
Oh God.
Why did I eat those potato scallops? 'Cause I'm having a holiday. I woke up at dawn from a disappointing sex dream. I am hiding in my room, waiting for the guests to depart. I am plotting my revenge on Lucas. I'm having a holiday.
That's Holiday. That's Kate Miller-Heidke from her new album, The Kiss and the Abyss. And you're listening to The Music Show. We're talking with Kate and Keir, although Keir hasn't said a word yet. I think he nodded at one point and there's a little chuckle.
He hasn't been given permission to speak.
Right. You asked him a question. He didn't know the answer.
Yeah.
I forgot. I'm well trained.
Holiday. Wow, that's a very funny song. I wouldn't want to be in Lucas's shoes.
Yeah, look, names have been changed to protect the innocent.
I figured they might have been, but I also wasn't sure it was you. So that's what you like on holiday, is it?
Well, not every holiday. Come on, Andy. But I think occasionally you have a holiday that you look forward to for so long, and it ends up somehow anticlimactic or disappointing. People get sick. I remember a Christmas holiday recently where we all had COVID, and then our kid gave us all nits. So we're just sitting there on Christmas Day scratching our heads and sneezing. It was horrific. But I think I read recently something that Alain de Botton said about holidays, which is that you shouldn't go into it feeling like you want to relax. you should, your mindset going into a holiday should be, who do I want to become on this holiday? So I'm going to try that next time.
That's even more pressure.
That's terrible. That's terrible. Yeah, well, look, but let's talk about comedy, because you've written a lot of very funny songs, and you are very good at singing them as well, which not everybody else would be. I mean, you sing them fairly straight. I guess they're funnier for that.
Well, that's very kind of you. Look, and I have to say Keir Nuttall here is a lot of help in that department too. He's a very funny man. He's got an alter ego called Frankie Walnut. So he's responsible for a lot of that. But early on in my songwriting career, when I was about 16 or 17, I went to a songwriting workshop at the Woodford Folk Festival, and I distinctly remember the great songwriter Christina Olsen saying on stage, you've got to make them laugh, because people get tired. They've had a long day at work. They're sitting in their seats. If you can get oxygen to their brains, that'll help keep them more alert. And the easiest way to do that is to make them laugh.
Good advice, yes. She's funny too. Let's talk about some of the models. I mean, you mentioned your operatic training, and we hear the voice, you know, in Elephant, for instance, on this album. But there's also, I don't know whether it's my imagination, I've been scratching my head listening to Love, Sweet Love. I'm convinced there's a baroque aria in there somewhere.
Sweet love, lay down with me. Give me your body, love.
Yeah, so I thought you'd pick that. Yeah, so it's basically a variation, that's what I'm calling it, not plagiarism, of, yeah, La Charque Pianga by Handel.
You can't get done for plagiarising Handel anyway.
Yeah, exactly, out of copyright. Yeah. Go and rip the whole thing off.
Yes.
But I have this idea, this concept of an idea, as Trump would say, about doing a variations record at some point in my future, where I take, you know, pick out the eyes of classical music, some of my favourite beautiful moments, and kind of moulding them into pop songs, you know, based on the variations tradition. So that's just another future project. But Love, Sweet Love is kind of proof of concept.
Yes, yes, and definitely should do that, I think. That would be very interesting. Now, you're going to do another live song for us, Little Ants. There's quite a bit of humour in this one as well, but I wonder whether you could set it up for us, because the context, I think, is quite important.
Yeah, so this was a song that we wrote during the pandemic. It was quite a bleak time. We were here in Melbourne in the full lockdown in the middle of winter, and it was a really rough time. We didn't know if music was ever coming back. We didn't know if theatres would ever reopen. We were sort of in this state of existential dread, and it was right after Black Summer as well, all that smoke that just covered Melbourne for months and months. And we started reading these articles about billionaire preppers, you know, in New Zealand and Tasmania, who were building their own private bunkers and training up their own private armies and growing hydroponic vegetables. And we started thinking about what our own apocalypse plan might look like. Keir started buying a lot of canned goods. we're in a much better space right now mentally. We're feeling a lot more relaxed about things, but yeah, this was our plan of, you know, which of our friends do we need to rope in, and how are we gonna survive the end of the world.
Names changed again?
Some of them, not all of them actually.
Okay, good. Oh well, we'll listen to the song and we'll try and work out who is real and who is not.
And I should mention that this song does contain a couple of swear words. Not too bad, not the worst, not the second worst. The third worst swear word makes a couple of appearances. So if you have sensitive ears, feel free to turn this one down.
Mm-hmm. someone who can kill. No Terra Madre hipster's gonna save us from marauders when the ship goes down. When the ship goes down, they'll be looting up on Rutgers Hill. Hungry yoga teachers fighting over cans of peaches when the ship goes down. When the ship goes down, I know that Ethan shits you, but he can do jujitsu. Could be useful in our clan. We need a plan. There's a storm coming, and we're just little ants. Abigail can shoot a gun. Up in America, where the shit goes down, where the shit goes down. We need Liam on our team. He grows all his own vegetables, knows which mushrooms are edible. When the ship goes down, we can live off Liam's greens. Know that Finn's a wanker, but he drives that off-road tanker, handy for the travel ban. We need a plan. There's a storm coming, and we're just little but you and I, we have no skills. So I protect and feed us. They'll probably try to eat us when the ship goes down. We'll be the first ones that they eat when the ship goes down. When the ship goes down. Ship goes down. I wonder if there's anything new on Netflix.
Little Ants by Kate Miller-Hyde Key, performed live in the ABC Music Studio by Kate and Keir Nuttall, and it's from her new album, The Kiss and the Abyss, which is out now. And Kate is going to be on tour from the 27th of August. You'll find the link to the dates on the Music Show's website. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National, and I'm Andrew Ford. Usually, performers and composers pass by each other gently, a performance here or there, but sometimes they come together and they shape each other's professional lives. Maki Namikawa has recorded lots of works for Orange Mountain Music, which is Philip Glass's record label, and she's given the first performances of several of his pieces as well, including many of his piano etudes. She's in Melbourne next week to perform the first 10 of the 20 etudes as part of the Now or Never Festival, and she'll join me in a moment. Let's listen to the beginning of etude number one.
Thank you.
That's the first of the Etudes for Piano by Philip Glass and played by Maki Namikawa. And it's a pleasure to welcome her to the music show. Hello.
Thank you so much for having me. Hello.
Hello. You're going to be playing the first 10 of these 20 Etudes, you've played them all. Maybe we could start by talking about you and Glass. I mean the music, not the man. What is it about Philip Glass's music that appeals to you?
Yeah, his music is very unique, and I never feel such like his music and other composers, because it's very strong and I can access my deepest emotion. I even have no idea exactly in my daily life, and the emotions which exist, thousand variation of them, but I really can find myself when I play his music.
An étude is a study. I mean, it's the French word for study, and there's two types of études, aren't there? There's the sort that you play to practice, and then there are these concert études by Chopin and Debussy, and now by Philip Glass, which are display pieces. But am I right that, like the Chopin and Debussy études, each of the Glass pieces also takes a particular kind of problem and tries to solve it?
Okay. The étude title is very typical Philip, I think. He never do some title very poetic or something. And that caused études, because he started actually for himself, actually, piano études, the daily piano practice for himself, it called Etudes. And this is, but more than Etudes, I think is like diary of his life. As you probably know, there's all 20 Etudes he composed in 20 years. And book one is older than one. And book two, he really had an idea as a concert piece. So book two is much more younger, and he concentrated about the concert pieces. But even the book one, which I'm going to perform at the festival in Melbourne, is I call always daily diary of his life.
And do the pieces, does the music itself change a lot from number one through to number 20, do you think?
Yes, exactly. Because in 20 years, his composing style has changed a lot. And also his life changed a lot. So it's his composing, the skills and the pieces are very, very close to, I think, his life. And I think his music never pushing a concrete emotion or a story. His music is a result of his thoughts, of his process in his life. And that's exactly what he shows in number one is very different as his number 20. But both beautiful.
Tell us about the difficulties of playing this music, would you, Maki?
Concentration. Concentration is very special. When I play his music on the stage, and always it helps a lot when I could make together with the audience in the hall, concert hall, and I'm feeling every time. This is also very unique and special feeling which I get from Philip's music. Concentration, and also the tiny things, just playing two notes or three notes, this very minimal the litmus or the each note, the concentration, the intense is enormously, and this is very hard to do, but this is the most beautiful thing in his music.
So the simplest bits are the hardest?
Yes. Like in our life, everything.
I know that Philip Glass has talked about your dedication, that you play 5-6 hours every day practicing. Does this make you sort of the ideal pianist for these etudes?
Oh, it's very honor. So there's many pianists, and then he's everybody's, you know, then every composer is very happy. So many pianists are playing. But I'm playing his music with joy, and because as I told you already, but when I play his music, I can find myself every time. And this is only one composer. This is Philip Glass's music. And daily, we have many emotions. We are living with many, many variations of emotions. And I also have no idea my emotions, but when I'm just sitting on the piano and to the piano and then start to his music, and then I think always I'm okay.
Does Philip Glass give you information about your performances? Has he suggested alternative approaches to some of the pieces?
Yes, especially when Philip composed for me 2019 Piano Sonata, we had many, many sessions together for our world premiere. That was also very fresh and very new and very different as our piano etudes rehearsal sessions. I know that he doesn't like to make too much, like to playing poetic or to many ritardandos or crescendo something. He never says something when somebody is playing like this with like Rachmaninoff or like Chopin. He never sing against his performances, but I know that his thought is very simple. And from simple, this stuff, this thing is coming more emotion or many messages very clearly, more clear if you play really simple. But simple is very tough things, and simple is very, actually very strong, and you have to be actually know yourself very much. And it's somehow very close to my homeland, Japan. We have some kinds of culture, I think, very often. And then I told also Philip, we talked about this a lot. Philip and I talked a lot about Japanese culture. And this is also, for him, is very familiar, I think. And our thought is very similar. This nothing or simple, this is, it telling us much more about you. Really have to know what you do, what will you want. And this process is very hard, but we are working very hard about this point very often. This is a beautiful moment to working with him.
Yes, yes. But keeping it simple is the way to find the emotion in the music, you think. You don't need to bring your own emotion. The music has the emotion right there.
Exactly, exactly. And like sky, for example, like sky, you or water, you are watching every day, but in every day you have another emotions, then you will watch the sky, but next day you watch differently as 10 years ago, 10 days ago, and something like that. So if you don't push too much emotions, concrete emotions, is the music or the thoughts, the idea is coming more straight and more directly and then more strong, and then this have more messages to us, to everybody.
Maki Namakawa, thank you very much for being my guest on The Music Show.
Thank you very much.
Maki Namakawa playing Etude Number 9 by Philip Glass. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I had a long conversation with Philip Glass at the Perth Festival in 2013 when his etudes were performed complete by three pianists, Maki Namakawa, Sally Whitwell, and Philip Glass himself. We recognize your music within a couple of seconds, usually. I mean, we know who the composer is. And I wonder whether there was a moment early in your career where you hit upon it, where you suddenly thought, oh, this is it, this is me.
I sometimes have thought, I don't teach anywhere, I haven't had, but I've sometimes often been asked to talk to students. And I kind of know what that's like to talk to compositors. I've never really had any students. And I would say to them, you know, I know that you're all worried about finding your voice. And they come, you know. I said, actually, it's actually not a problem. By the time, they're all in their 20s. By the time you're 30, you'll have found your voice. But that's not the problem. The problem is getting rid of it. And they have no idea what I'm talking about. Of course, you don't. Now, like the pieces that are going to be played tomorrow night, it's a set of 20 pieces written over 20 years. I wonder whether that'll be a good test. I'm sorry that people will know, of course, it's me, because that's why they're going to hear it. But those pieces, if they get recorded and played on the radio, I don't know that people will know that. Mm. Actually, what happens, as you, of course, you know, over a lifetime of playing, of writing and playing, there are changes in the music, but they happen so slowly that you don't... anything within 5 years sounds alike. But you get to 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, and it doesn't sound at all.
But it's I mean, you were alluding to this, but it's difficult when you yourself recognize your own style, isn't it, as a composer? Because what do you do?
Well, there are two sides to that. One is the struggle to develop a technical language, and also to develop a performance style to go with it. And that goes together. Any new music has to have a new way of playing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be new, clearly. But at the beginning, I could spend years working through a problem. Because no one cared what I did anyway, so I had plenty of time. There wasn't anyone actually waiting for pieces. I put on concerts all the time, and people came. But I built up an audience that way. But when I say people, I don't mean none of them are music people, or very few. There were a few in New York at that time that would come. Frederick Jeffsky would come sometimes, and Steve Reich would come. People I knew would come, people who were kind of in the same boat that I was in. But the great thing about that period is that actually no one cares what you're doing. So you can, you're free in a certain way.
It's not just that a new kind of music needs a new way of playing, a new kind of music needs a new way of listening as well. And I suppose the fact that...
It's almost as difficult.
But your audience was coming from, you know, the visual arts, from dance, from photography. And that's probably significant, isn't it, that they weren't?
It's simply like this. In the world of the visual arts, the rate of change in that world is very rapid compared to music. Oh, I'd say during the 60s and 70s, every 5 years there would be a pop art, or there would be... We started with abstract expressionists, and then you had pop art, and then you had a color field, and then you went through this. And it would happen fairly regularly, so that there was an expectation, and therefore, and a kind of an appetite for change in the world of the visual arts that doesn't exist in the music world. In fact,
the contrary.
On the contrary, exactly. So that, however, I found my audiences in the art world. I gave my first concerts in museums, in galleries, and the first concert I gave, it was just full of artists, and they helped me carry the speakers and everything. I mean, they were my friends. And the first patrons were artists who either bought scores, like Saul would. Did that a lot. He did that for a lot. He liked music, and he simply bought scores from young composers. They all went up to a museum in Connecticut, and they ended up there. I think he just was trying to find an excuse to give everyone $1,000 from time to time. It wasn't a lot of money, but $1,000 in 1960, 1970 could be a lot of money. So the support did not come from the music world, it came from the art world. And the audiences came from the art world. And what happened is that that turns out to be a rather large world, actually. When I did a piece like Music in 12 Parts, I would do a part of it, but 2 or 3 months it would be a new part. And I would announce it by Xeroxing pieces of paper and putting signs around. And I had a loft on Bleecker Street, and it was on the 7th floor, and people would just walk up. And it would, 40, 50, 100 people would come up. And I premiered every 2 or 3 months. I did a new part until I got through the 12. And then I took the whole bunch and did a concert in Town Hall. And then they all came. And it turned out we sold out Town Hall. I didn't realize we had gotten such a large audience. It had taken 3 years to build it up. But none of those people were in the music world. And my closest musician friends were in the same boat that I was in.
You were supported financially, you said, by some visual artists. What about...
Well, I wouldn't say... it wasn't exactly supported. I still had day jobs, but it was a big help.
But was there an artistic influence? I mean, when did the work of these painters affect
let's
the
put it this way.
You wrote?
The people I spoke with all the time, they were writers and painters and sculptors. And in fact, I worked for 3 years as a studio assistant for Richard Serra. But we knew each other from Europe. And when he got back to New York, he got a gallery right away. And I was working, I had some day job or other. And he asked me to come and work for him. And I did that for 3 years. We spent a lot of time talking about art because in order to be useful in the studio, he had to educate me. So we would go to museums and so we spent, sometimes we wouldn't do any work at all. We'd just go around and look at art.
Did you think you were being radical in the 60s and early 70s when you were writing this music?
No. There was nothing like that. Nothing like that. That would have presumed that that was a strategy aimed towards some ultimate success. Mm. There was no strategy like that in our minds at all. When I say we, I mean, because there were other people around, too. I wasn't alone in this. But we were very close to the theater world. There were a lot of theaters downtown, like Richard Foreman and Bob Wilson, for that matter. I got to know him that way. Many of us worked out of La Mama or out of the Public Theater. There was a lot of interaction between theater people and dance people and music people. The thing that was confusing to my friends who were had conservatory jobs was that I actually had a music education. And I had been to Juilliard, I had degrees, and this and that, a full right to study, and I was in my bones. So I wasn't exactly a moron, but though I was accused of being one, or at least an idiot savant or something kind of.
Thank you.
In the Upper Room, dance number 8, music by Philip Glass. And that piece is being performed by Orchestra Victoria, also at the Now or Never Festival, on the same programme as the Etudes played by Maki Namikawa. Friday, August the 21st, and you'll find a link to the event on our website. The music show is produced by C. Benedict and Sky Kirkham. Technical production this week from Antonia Garchi and Brendan O'Neill. The music show is made on Gadigal, Gundungurra and Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country. And coming up, we have the Berlin-based Australian composer Thomas Meadowcroft, who's bringing Foley to the concert hall, and a song cycle inspired by the writings of Lacan. Two separate shows they are, and the American poet Aja Monet on her second album, The Colour of Rain.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.